When Lane Eskins, Catherine Philippou, Israel Lopez, and Alfredo Santiago gave their taped statements to Baltimore Police Internal Affairs in January and February of 2016, they each brought along a guest, their Fraternal Order of Police appointed attorney, Michael Davey. By the time the officers were compelled, they were no longer at risk of being criminally charged for the shooting of Keith Davis Jr. in June of 2015. Their interviews were for the internal administrative investigation, aimed at determining whether their actions had violated any police policies. It's not unusual that the officers brought along legal representation. They have that right, and plenty of officers exercise it, with Davey or his colleague, Irv Wiener, sitting in. The difference in this case, of course, is that all four officers were set to testify about the events of June 7, 2015, a few weeks later at a public trial in which their accounts would be scrutinized by the media, Keith Davis Jr.'s defense attorney, and a jury.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is The State versus Keith Davis Jr. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the book Adnan's Story. Join me as we continue to follow the story of Keith Davis Jr. as told by our investigator and reporter, Amelia McDonald Perry.
We need to talk about something. Constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. You tell yourself it's not that bad. You take laxatives and modify your diet and exercise routine. But thinking about it all the time is frustrating. Do you find yourself making up excuses instead of admitting to people you don't want to go out because you're worried about leaving home? Despite your best efforts to feel better, your symptoms keep coming back. This feels all too relatable. You're not alone. If your gut symptoms return again and again, you don't know why, it may be time to seek help. Like 13 million others, you might have a real medical condition called irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, or IBS-C. To get more info about your symptoms and IBS-C, go to ohmygut.info/podcast. Learn about your constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. And if you're ready, find out ways to talk to your doctor or access one online. That's ohmygut.info/podcast. ohmygut.info/podcast.
There are certain rules that legal counsel is supposed to follow when sitting in on an officer's interview with Internal Affairs. Here's Detective Joseph Peremski reading that portion of the standard preamble at the start of his interview with Officer Eskins.
During this tape interrogation, counsel may request a recess at any time to consult with a law enforcement officer. Counsel may also object to any question posed. However, speaking objections will not be allowed in the presence of the officer. If counsel wishes, he may state on the record outside the presence of the law enforcement officer the reason for objection.
Before the interview starts, Davey also gives a little spiel on behalf of his client.
As a result of being ordered to appear here today, Officer Eskins also understands that order also includes an order to give a statement and or answer questions related to this matter. He further understands that his failure to give a statement and or answer questions would cause for additional disciplinary action taken against him and the possible loss of his employment. And by giving a statement here today, Officer Eskins is not waiving any of his rights, either under the United States Constitution, Maryland Declaration of Rights, or the Maryland Law Enforcement Officers' Bill of Rights. Thank you.
But otherwise, with the exception of objecting to a question, Michael Davey is supposed to keep a lid on it. Unfortunately...
Is there anything you care about?
Can I just ask one follow-up question? Is there any doubt in your mind that the individual who you shot is the same individual who fired the vehicle when you first approached him with the gun?
No doubt in my mind. I never lost sight of him.
At any time, were you in fear for your life and the safety of your fellow officers?
Absolutely. Scariest thing I've been through in this department yet.
Look, I get it. Peremski is a terrible interviewer and investigator, but does anyone affiliated with the Baltimore Police Department actually have any respect for the accountability process. At that point, it was not yet clear whether the defense would be able to use the officers' IAD statements to refresh their memory or impeach their testimony at Keith's trial. But Davey has a duty to look out for his client's best interests, which I imagine would include their overall credibility as sworn police officers. By sitting in on all four interviews, Davey was privy to the conflicts in their testimony, which could reasonably lead 12 jurors and a judge to question whether they were telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Wouldn't Davey have an obligation to at the very least alert them to what he perceived to be weaknesses in their testimony? He couldn't tell the officers why without violating attorney-client privilege, but there was nothing stopping them from speaking with each other and working out the kinks themselves. Eskins, Philippou, Lopez, and Santiago were still assigned to Northwest District Patrol, and they continued to work together and with the other witnessing officers. They were also all friends outside of work.
Have you discussed this incident with any of those officers before now?
We talk all the time. Officers talk all the time about the things that have happened.
Well, that puts my concerns to rest. How about yours? There are numerous instances in which the officers' trial testimonies were distinctly different from the accounts given to Internal Affairs just a few weeks before. Some definitely make me more suspicious than others, but the impact really varies. I'm going to start with a seemingly straightforward contradiction about a relatively minor detail that, in my opinion, really should provoke reasonable doubt that the officers could be so sure that Keith robbed hack driver Charles Holden. First, here's a clip of Officer Eskin's interview with IAD on January 19th, 2016.
I had yelled to him to put the weapon down several times as I was chasing him, but he never put it down.
A month later, prosecutor Lizette Ringgold Kirksey asked Eskins whether he shouted any verbal commands during the foot chase, and he responded as follows.
And do you recall whether or not, as you were chasing the defendant, if you were saying anything to him at the time that you were running after him?
I wasn't saying anything to him.
On its own, this is a relatively small discrepancy that could be easily explained by the fallibility of human memory. A contradiction isn't necessarily evidence of willful deception. This particular contradiction does undermine one of Eskin's more consistent claims, though, that he was only a short distance behind the armed robbery suspect for the entire length of the foot chase, at most the width of the street from one curb to the next, and he never lost sight of him. The Baltimore Police Department didn't have an official policy regarding foot pursuits until last year, but officers are trained to immediately broadcast a suspect description, whether they may be armed, and the direction of travel so that adequate resources are swiftly deployed. If and when the fleeing subject is within earshot, issuing verbal commands is the next obvious step towards de-escalating the situation, and really should be second nature. The exception would be if the subject was too far away or hearing impaired, in which case an officer may make a conscious decision to focus on directing backup units towards hopefully intercepting their path. That's exactly what Santiago was aiming to do when he hopped in his police-issued Chevy Tahoe and hit the gas after hearing Eskins call out the foot chase that morning. The Northwest District Station was less than a quarter mile away, and the parking lot is technically accessible via both Linden Heights Avenue and Reisterstown Road, which both run parallel to St. Charles and intersect with West Belvedere Avenue and the alley to its rear. Linden Heights Avenue is a one-way, single-lane residential street one block south of St. Charles Avenue that basically dead-ends at the district parking lot. But the station is actually located on Reisterstown Road, which is one block south of Linden Heights and has two lanes running in both directions. One block south of Reisterstown Road is Eleanor Avenue. Santiago and Eskins both testified that Santiago sped the wrong way down Linden Heights and was approaching the alley when the armed robber darted in front of his vehicle. Santiago hit the brakes to avoid hitting Eskins, who was following close behind. Officer Diana Brown, however, testified that Santiago was several car lengths in front of her patrol vehicle when she left the district via Reisterstown Road. He had already passed the alley when the suspect ran in front of her car, Brown said, and she didn't see Eskins or Philippou in pursuit. Philippou had no recollection of seeing either Santiago or Brown en route to the garage when she testified, but in her statement to IAD a month earlier, she recalled that Santiago almost struck Eskins as he was running across Reisterstown Road. Linden Heights was definitely a better route for the state's armed robbery case. By identifying Keith near the start of the foot chase, Santiago was certainly more helpful than victim Charles Holden, who testified that Keith, quote, didn't look like the man who robbed him. The defense's theory was that the armed robber had a significant lead from the jump, and as a result, Eskins and Philippou barely got a glimpse at him before he disappeared down the alley. Instead of calling off the foot chase, they kept running, and as they got closer to Reisterstown Road, Keith bolted into their field division, and the officers mistakenly assumed they'd found their armed robber. I've gone up to Park Heights a few times and walked the foot chase route, although there's now a chain link fence at the entrance to the alley between Reisterstown Road and Eleanor Avenue. So to get to the garage, you actually have to walk around the block via West Belvedere. Anyway, there's a really big blind spot at the very start of the foot chase route, where the alley intersects with St. Charles Avenue. There's an auto repair shop on the left that encroaches into the alley itself, narrowing the width and making it impossible to see more than a few feet into the alley unless you're directly in front of it. Between St. Charles and Reisterstown, the path is a relatively straight shot, but there are plenty of cars parked on both sides, which creates additional blind spots the whole way down. About halfway down the first alley block between St. Charles and Linden Heights, there's an unnamed street that cuts to the right, with residences on both sides and at least a handful of porches to dive under. There's a similar unnamed street halfway down the alley block between Linden Heights and Reisterstown Road. Plus, on the left, there's a used car lot with a scalable fence and a lot of inventory to hide between. If the armed robber got even, I don't know, a 5-second lead on Eskins and Philippou, it's totally plausible that he could have made the first right down the cut and disappeared. The bigger the head start, the more options he would have had to vanish. The officers wouldn't necessarily even realize that they'd lost their suspect before Keith caught their eye in the distance and their adrenaline kicked up another notch. The officers' police radio transmissions during the foot chase, which began just past 9:50 a.m., fit with this scenario almost seamlessly. Certainly more so than the prosecution's case at Keith's armed robbery trial, which may be one reason why the state didn't introduce the dispatch audio into evidence or play a single transmission for the jury. As far as I know, the defense was never even provided with the audio during discovery. It wasn't until Keith's second trial that the dispatch audio surfaced, but the state only introduced the portion covering the 3.5-block, minute-long foot pursuit. That's a very tiny fraction of what's actually available. There are radio transmissions about the incident until at least the late afternoon. I only recently obtained a copy of the audio, and whoo boy, it blew my mind. I'm still digesting its overall significance, so for now, I'm just going to broadcast the audio during the foot pursuit, which is already on the public record. Police audio communications sound like straight-up gibberish at first, but it's worth listening to. Every word will be included in the transcript for this episode on our website, but there are a couple bits and pieces that I want to talk about in more depth, even though the jury in this particular case didn't get the chance. One thing to keep in mind as you listen, patrol officers identify themselves by their call numbers, which are 4 digits long and indicate the officer's assigned district, shift, and unit number. The Northwest is the 6th District, and the officers were working the Baker shift, so their call numbers begin with 6 Baker or 6B, plus their 2-digit unit number. There are some unit numbers that stay consistent. The lieutenant or the highest permanent rank supervisor on duty is always 09. Sergeants get a 0 at the end, so 10, 20, 30, etc. And any officer assigned to drive the prisoner transport van is given a unit number that starts with 9. Sometimes officers use all 4 digits to identify themselves on the radio. Sometimes they just use their 2-digit unit number. For your own reference, on June 7th, 2015, Eskins was 91. Sergeant Santiago was 09 because he was in charge of the district that morning. Lopez was 46 and Philippou was 26. But for some reason, she kept using 44. You'll also hear a bunch of other numbers called 10 codes, which are shorthand for common transmissions and requests, like 1020, which is what a dispatcher might say if he wants to know a fleeing suspect's general location and direction of travel.
Yeah, a guy run off the street with a gun in his hand. St. Charles. 221 St. Charles.
221 St. Charles.
He's got a gun to St. Charles. He's going up the alley. Where the district?
221 St. Charles. Hey, where are you on St. Charles?
Linden Heights. He's got a gun. Linden Heights. He's got a gun. Head towards the Bicester Sound Road. And George Underground Road. He's got a gun in his hand. He's right hand. coming out the license cam. Coming out the license cam. I'm sorry, it's crossing the street. Right there.
Crossing the street on Linden Heights, armed with a gun. Linden Heights.
What do you say? Where else?
He's right here in red glasses, white feet, or blue jeans.
Any other?
Copy, just one after Ross. He's got a going, Josh.
Unit copy, unit cross.
You got Ross, just a tie.
Where are you guys at? Me and 18 are coming up.
Shot fired, shot fired.
About 20 seconds into the audio, the Northwest dispatcher asked for a 1020 from 6 Baker 91 or 6 Baker 26. Eskin says that he's at Linden Heights and heading towards Reisterstown Road. This is the transmission that prompted Sergeant Santiago to run to his vehicle and allegedly drive down Linden Heights to intercept the fleeing armed robber. But I don't buy it. The district may be close, and Santiago looks like a guy who drives with a lead foot. But taking Reisterstown Road would have given him a much better shot. When Eskin says, he's crossing the street, he's right there, he's got a gun in his hand, he sounds like he's actually directing an officer he can actually see. My best guess is that from his position in the alley, Eskin saw Keith running across Reisterstown Road seconds before the Tahoe rolled into his line of sight. By that point, a man with a gun was the extent of the suspect description. Eskins and Philippou hadn't even reported whether they were chasing a number one or number two male, the numbers being cop shorthand for black male or white male. That's a pretty solid indication that the officers hadn't actually gotten a good look at the armed robber to begin with. About 10 seconds later, Philippou tells the responding units he's light-skinned, dark glasses, wife beater, blue jeans. A straightforward description of Keith's outfit that morning. That's her shouting somewhat gleefully, shots fired, shots fired, about 15 seconds later, by the way. But I'll come back to her in a bit.
Alarm, the willies, uneasiness, panic. There are dozens of words for fear, but just one for an exceptional home security company to stop fear at your front door, SimpliSafe. I've been using SimpliSafe's whole home protection and I've never felt safer. It's 24/7 monitoring of your home for intruders, fires, water damage, and medical emergencies. SimpliSafe is home security that knows it feels good to fear less. This is award-winning 24/7 protection that protects your home through it all, through blizzards, blackouts, and burglars. SimpliSafe has won awards from all the tech experts that count. The Verge calls it the best home security. It's won Reader's Choice from PC Magazine, to two-time winner of CNET's Editor's Choice, and a Wirecutter top pick. SimpliSafe has no contract, no hidden fees, and no gotchas, and they always keep their prices fair and honest. Thanks to SimpliSafe, fear has no place in a place like home. Now you can try SimpliSafe with free shipping and free returns. You'll get a 60-day risk-free trial. Order now and you have your home protected within a week. Go to simplisafe.com/undisclosed to get started today. That's simplisafe.com/undisclosed. Be sure to go there so they know we sent you. simplisafe.com/undisclosed.
Meet Martina Washington. The first shot fired into Big Herb's auto repair that morning nearly took her head off.
When you ran out of the shop, did you see the police at any time?
Yes, it was a police lady. Yes, it was a police lady at the front door, and she shot the gun off when I ran out the door. She shot the gun off and it went past my face.
So once you ran out of the shop, where, if anywhere, did you go?
I ran out and I ran on down. That was it. I was laying on the ground because I was scared. Because the police people shot the gun.
So you were laying on the ground right outside the shop?
Yes.
And do you recall where Mr. Berkeley was at the time, your fiance?
He was still inside.
Okay. Did he come out at some point in time?
He came out right behind me.
And when he came out, do you recall where he went?
He came right beside me and was on top of me because I was kind of scared. I wasn't scared of the person that was in there. I was scared of the police because the police had shot right past me. And that's why I was trembling like that.
Martina's fiance, Bernard Berkeley, is Big Herb's son. And the two of them were at the garage early that morning to clean. Big Herb had left for church services and the shop was closed that day. But Bernard's brother, who happens to be called Brother, was supposed to be coming by, so they left the bay doors wide open. Here's what happened when Keith ran inside.
I was just sweeping and somebody just ran in and with a gun and I just ran out.
The person that ran in with the gun, do you recall seeing the gun?
I know I seen the gun. That's about all that I seen.
And at the moment that you saw the gun, do you know where you were in the shop?
Well, who was that?
Where were you at the time when you saw the gun? Like, where were you in the shop?
I was by the office door.
Do you recall what the person looked like that had the gun?
I couldn't say how that person looked because I really didn't, you know, I didn't look to see. I didn't look at no face or nothing like that. So I couldn't tell you how he looked.
Do you recall what you were looking at the time?
I was just looking at the gun. That's all I'm looking at. That's all I need to look at.
Do you recall the police asking you what color the gun was?
That was downtown.
Right. Do you recall that?
Yes, I did.
And what did you tell them?
It was black.
And do you recall the police asking you which hand the gun was in?
Yes, I do remember them saying that.
And what did you tell the police?
I said, I don't know. I wasn't paying attention. I don't know.
Martina Washington is the only other person besides the police officers who claim that Keith had a gun in his hand that morning. Keith has always denied this, but Martina is certain. Here's her more detailed description of this gun on cross-examination. Please excuse the sirens in the background. That's Baltimore for you.
Being asked what this gun looked like when you were at the police station, you described it as black, square.
I said it was black.
Do you recall saying that it was square?
I don't recall.
You were drinking that day? Well, what time did you start drinking?
In the morning.
What time in the morning?
7 o'clock in the morning.
About 7. Were you drinking at home?
Home and out.
Did you go to the shop? Were you drinking at the shop?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember if your fiance was drinking with you?
He don't drink. He drinks beer.
At the time, you've been drinking since about 7 a.m. to around the time when the police showed up? Do you remember what time the police showed up?
I guess about 10 something.
And so were you drinking consistently from about 7 to 10?
Not drinking. No, not drinking.
Do you remember what you were drinking?
Liquor.
Was it hard liquor?
Yes.
White or dark?
Dark.
And at the time, you testified that this person that came into the garage had something in his hand, right?
Yes.
Do you remember if the person had more than one object in his hand, or was it just one object?
Only seen one thing.
It was just one thing. And in the other hand, did he say anything in his other hand?
I wasn't looking at nothing. Oh, I just looked at one thing, and that's all I needed to see.
Okay. Is it possible that that black square thing was a cell phone?
No.
Can you describe this gun that you say you saw?
I can't describe it because I just glanced over at it, but I know a cell phone is not a cell phone.
Maybe Martina really believed she saw a gun, but what she describes doesn't match the gun that was actually recovered, a Hammerly Trailside 22 with a multicolored handle. The lights were out in the garage that morning, and it was really dark inside. Officer Brown said she had to use a flashlight to look for shell casings, and Officers Dean McFadden and Thomas Kirby Jr. both described the garage as so dark they could not see inside. Bernard, on the other hand, didn't even really get a good look at Keith, but he heard him ask if there was another way out. There wasn't, and Bernard was focused on following Martina outside to find out what was wrong.
You said that when you came up out of the garage, there was a shot, right?
Yeah.
You believe that the person shooting was a Baltimore City police officer?
It was the Baltimore City police officer.
Was the person wearing a uniform?
Yes, she was.
Do you recall where you were when the person shot?
I was running out of the shop.
Had you crossed the threshold of the shop, or were you still physically inside the shop?
Like, physically, you might as well say I was physically, like, and get ready to come out the garage.
So you were still inside the garage? And before you crossed the threshold to going outside, that person had shot. Do you know if they shot towards your direction?
Yes, they did.
Did you feel a whiz by your face?
You can hear someone shh.
By your ear?
Yes, ma'am.
By your left ear?
All right.
By your right ear. So while you're coming out, is the person facing you?
Yes.
Can you describe this officer, his or her gender?
She black.
She was an African-American woman? And at that time, have you seen any other police officers?
She was the only one I saw at first. That's the only one I seen.
According to the Baltimore Police Department's use of force investigation, just one female officer fired her weapon that morning, Catherine Philippou, who is Hispanic and Filipino. She has black hair, though, and it was June, so maybe she had a solid base tan going. Besides, Martina had been drinking brown liquor all morning, there was a glare outside, and fear can really cloud one's memory. However, one detail that the first four officers on scene do agree on, in both their IAD statements and their trial testimonies, is that Philippou did not fire the first round. Sergeant Santiago did. Where he was standing, who was with him, and how many rounds were discharged is where their accounts once again diverge. At the armed robbery trial, both Eskins and Santiago testified that they arrived on Eleanor Avenue at the same time, seconds after Keith ran into the garage to the left. Here's Eskins.
When Sergeant Santiago had the bumper up in front of his face and we circled into the garage, we do a stack formation. He goes in, I go in behind him. I stay just off to his right or just off to his left, depending upon which way we're going in. As he went in, I immediately saw the defendant holding his gun out, facing myself and Sergeant Santiago. At that point in time, I yelled, "Look out, gun."
And at that point in time, were you still in the entrance of the garage, or were you, do you know exactly where you were when you initially saw the defendant turn around and point the gun at you and Officer Santiago?
We had taken about two steps into the garage. We had berthed the plane and we were about two steps inside the garage.
So in looking at State Exhibit number 13, when you say you were in the garage, are you saying you were just past the threshold?
Yes.
State Exhibit number 13, is that fair to say?
Yes.
And so after you got across the threshold and the defendant pointed the gun at you and Officer Santiago, what, if anything, did you and Officer Santiago do next?
Sergeant Santiago began to fire his weapon.
Okay.
As we backed out of the door, we were backing out to take a position at the corner, and he began firing his weapon. As we got to the doorway itself, I looked down and I saw Sergeant Santiago's weapon in a lockback, which I knew that his weapon was empty, the magazine was empty.
Santiago's statement to Internal Affairs was consistent with his trial testimony, but Eskins changed his account dramatically. 1 month earlier, he didn't think that stack formation was such a great idea.
Sergeant Santiago gets out and goes to the left side of the garage opening. When Sarge goes in, I see the guy standing there holding a gun, pointing it at him. I yell, "He's got a gun." Sarge begins to fire as he backs himself out and around the garage door. I look over and I see Sarge's gun come to a lockback. I know he fired to a lockback.
Where were you positioned at?
Right there.
And be advised, the officer pointed to a photograph showing the entrance to the garage, and he's pointing to the wall entrance right side of the garage. Why did you take that tactical position?
When the suspect ran into the garage, he ran in and went to the left. When Sergeant Santiago got out and I circled around the vehicle, Sarge also went to the left, so I went to the right.
Okay.
I didn't want to stack up behind him.
Okay.
At trial, Santiago and Eskins testified that they walked several feet into the garage and saw Keith standing near the left side wall, pointing a gun in their direction. Martina and Bernard ran out of the garage within seconds of Santiago firing his weapon, but it's not clear which happened first.
Did you see a man and a woman inside the garage?
I saw them when we were walking inside. They were coming out.
So when you were walking in, the man and the woman were coming out at the same time?
Yes, ma'am.
So they came out before any shots were fired. Is that your testimony?
At the same time, They were out. I was entering on the left side, and they were coming out at that point.
So your testimony is that you guys crossed the threshold of the garage at the same time?
Yes, ma'am, pretty much.
And so Officer Eskins was with you when the man and the woman were coming outside, correct?
That's correct.
And so Officer Eskins was to your rear, to your right, or to your left?
He was behind me on my right side.
Did the man and the woman pass Officer Eskins on their way out the door?
They passed both of us.
They passed both of you?
Both officers agree that Santiago kept firing until he emptied all 14 rounds inside his magazine, otherwise known as a lockback. Did any of those rounds actually hit Keith? They don't say, but Keith was shot in the arm first, and it likely happened when he was still out in the open and not yet behind the refrigerator. The crime scene photos don't thoroughly account for all of the bullet holes around the garage, but the garage was actually open for business on my most recent trip to Park Heights, and I got to see them for myself. Big Herb passed away sometime during the last year, and his son, Brother Berkeley, is now running the shop, and he allowed me to take some photos. I was crossing my fingers that the refrigerator would still be inside. I had every intention of buying it so that it could finally be given the thorough assessment it should have received 4 years ago. Unfortunately, Brother told me that the fridge was already broken at the time of the shooting, and it eventually found its way to a landfill. My heart is still a little broken about that. Anyway, the left side wall of the garage was riddled with at least a half dozen bullet holes. A couple of the bullets passed all the way through the left wall and entered into one of the small rooms on the other side, where the crime tech found a deformed bullet and a metal fragment. The holes appear to corroborate Santiago's account of firing at Keith before he took cover behind the fridge, but thankfully he's not a great shot. But as my ex-Baltimore police buddy Larry Smith Jr. explains, not all of the ballistics evidence fits perfectly with Santiago's account.
Santiago emptied a full magazine. Where they would have entered the garage with the bunker initially, I don't see a lot of shell casings inside the garage. I see a lot of shell casings outside of the garage. Supposedly they went in, you know, in this stack formation, as Eskins calls it, and they backed out, but somehow they separated and went in an opposite direction. Santiago seems to cease being involved once they back out of the garage. That's when Eskins apparently takes over the scene. He's giving commands. He's firing his weapon. You know, there's so many details that are just left to Eskins to deliver.
Larry is totally right about the shell casings, and I will be forever infuriated that they weren't collected and retained individually according to the evidence number assigned at the scene. When a bullet is fired, the discarded shell casing retains tiny impressions left by the gun's inner mechanized hardware. These are called tool marks, and there's a whole realm of forensic science devoted to matching ballistic evidence to the weapon it was fired from by comparing these characteristics. Firearm tool mark identification is fascinating and it has some merit, particularly when certain limitations are imposed, like matching all of the .40 caliber shell casings recovered from the garage to the four weapons that were fired that morning. The firearms unit performed that exact analysis on June 15th, 8 days after the shooting. But it would have been even more valuable to know where each shell casing was recovered from. While casings are lightweight and can be kicked around or deliberately moved, overall, that type of analysis would have been a reliable indicator of where the four shooting officers were standing each time they pulled the trigger. Unfortunately, the detectives from the force investigation team didn't care. As Larry noted, after Santiago emptied his magazine inside the garage, he and Eskins backed out of the garage so he could reload, while Keith, who may have been struck in the arm, ran to the back of the garage and eventually took cover behind the refrigerator. Santiago's role becomes much more minimal at this point, while Eskins takes center stage, but their accounts of what that actually looks like wildly diverge from each other and from the remaining officers on scene. Santiago says he reloaded his gun on the left side of the bay doors, holstered his gun, and then crossed over to the right side, shielding himself with the bunker, in order to provide cover for Eskins for the remainder of the incident.
And then at that point, I went to a lockback, my gun. So I start walking back to the main door, staying on the left side of the door. I reload my gun. Officer Eskins went to the right side. He was doing cover on that side. Then I moved with him to that corner, with the bunker, tried to protect him. At that point, I already got my gun holstered, Eskin start giving instructions to this person that was behind the fridge at this point.
And so once the defendant was behind the fridge, what, if anything, else occurred after that?
At that point, like I said, I was trying to provide some kind of cover to Officer Eskins. And I saw the officers coming, so I tried to hold them back because I don't need no more officers on the front door. So I tried to hold them back, and I let Eskins take control at that point. And every time that he saw the gentleman pointing the gun at us, he said he's pointing, and he yelled at him to surrender, to drop the gun. And Eskin started discharging his gun every time that he come out of the fridge and pointed a gun.
At any point in time, did you discharge your gun?
After I did my reload now. Before I did my reload, yes, at the beginning, when I walked in, I discharged my gun.
You can see Santiago's bunker in the crime scene photos. It's lying on the ground at the back of the garage, about 10 or so feet from the refrigerator. There are a few close-ups. So there's clear plastic protective backing stuck to the shield's window that has not been removed, which probably made Santiago's view a little cloudy. It literally looks brand new, like it's never actually been used. It almost looks like a prop. According to Larry, who spent 18 years in the Baltimore Police Department, it might as well be.
And then where there's a huge difference is the bunker. Mm-hmm. Now, what Eskin says makes sense. That he saw Santiago shoot to a lockback.
Which is, can you explain what a lockback is?
The lockback is when you fire your gun till it's empty, the slide will lock back because it's a semi-automatic. So as it cycles through, when you firing rounds and it's cycling through, the slide comes back and then moves forward to pull the next round up out of the magazine. So when it's empty, it locks back. You put a new magazine up into it, you have to manually release the slide to chamber the next round. So Eskins sees him shoot to a lockback, but he never mentions the bunker. And then he brings the bunker in after the fact when the person they've shot is on the ground and now they're approaching him to take him into custody. That makes way more sense to me than Philippou's. He ran into the garage and Sarge got the bunker and I took cover behind him in the bunker during the shootout. Like, it made no sense to me.
A bunker is like more like a shield, kind of, right?
Yeah, it's a shield. But again, the ones in the patrol vehicles are not the nice ballistic bunkers like they have in SWAT that can take certain rounds. Like, the ones in patrol were junk. Like, I wouldn't trust it to stop anything, mm-hmm. honestly. I wouldn't take cover behind that and nothing else. Bunker's not designed to be pulled out and dropped in the middle of the street and use this cover when there's cars and stuff. The bunker coming into play in Eskin's version makes total sense to me. In Philippou's version, it makes no sense to me. And the fact that he mentions it after he sees Santiago shoot to a lockback and they have this shootout, supposedly, and now they're going in to get him, yeah, that makes sense. But I also think that Philippou is either lying or she can't remember what she's supposed to say.
Anyway, according to Eskins, he and Santiago stood on opposite sides of the bay doors for the remainder of the incident. Eskins describes quite a scene.
The defendant then ran to the back of the garage into an opening. There was, I guess it was a room, I didn't know at the time, there was a room in the back of the garage. And he was kind of erratically running, ran inside and then came back out of the room. My sergeant, when he fired, he had backed himself out of the garage to the corner. To the left corner of the opening of the garage. I immediately took a position at the right corner of the garage. As the defendant came out, he had raised a gun up, was pointed at us as if he was running from my left to my right. Went to behind what I found out at that time was a refrigerator. Came out from behind the refrigerator and had the gun in his right hand and held the gun up as it came out of behind the refrigerator. I began firing several shots from my duty weapon. And I watched the defendant fall. I saw him fall to the ground. I watched the gun come out of his hand. The gun fell about 2 feet from him. As he was on the ground, he reached over and grabbed the gun, brought it back over to him, slid behind the refrigerator.
The echoing gunshots and ricocheting bullets were also drowning in the wail of police sirens, and both responding officers and civilians weren't sure if this was an actual shootout.
Right down on Belvedere, right down on Belvedere. The cross street is Belvedere. It's a lot of police. They're having a shootout right now, man.
Okay, who's having a shootout?
The police having a shootout with some clown. Okay. And this guy is banging off on the police.
Okay, who's having a shootout?
I don't know who it is. It's some dude that just ran through the alley, and now they up in the alley shooting. They only had like 22 shots.
One thing Eskins and Santiago do agree on is that Santiago reloaded, but he didn't discharge any more rounds for the duration of the shooting. All 14 of Santiago's rounds were fired inside the garage before Keith took cover. That's not what Diana Brown, Catherine Philippou, or really any other officer on scene remembers. Brown's patrol car followed Santiago's Tahoe from the district, while Philippou says she was less than 10 feet behind Eskins during the foot chase, and they both recalled seeing Santiago grab the bunker from his trunk. Eskins took a tactical position on the right side of the bay doors, while Santiago went to the left side. Brown positioned herself directly behind Santiago. So did Philippou. They each testified that Martina Washington and Bernard Berkeley came running out of the garage when Santiago fired the first shot. But at no point did either officer witness Santiago actually enter the garage with or without Eskins and discharge even one, let alone 14 rounds in rapid succession while he was inside.
Sergeant Santiago positioned his vehicle tactically. He lifted up the back of the vehicle, retrieved the bunker. Officer Lane came through the alley, and he was on the opposite, was on the opposite side of the garage door. So we were on, myself and Sergeant Santiago was on the, the left side of the garage, and Lane Eskins was on the right side of the garage. At which time, they gave verbal commands to drop the weapon, and then the first shot was fired.
Officer Filippo, do you recall when you arrived at the garage, which other officers were there prior to you getting there?
Well, Officer Eskins was a couple feet in front of me, and Sergeant Santiago just pulled up.
So Santiago was there, and Eskins was there already, correct?
Yes.
And when you arrived, had Santiago and Eskins already gone inside the garage?
No.
Did you witness them go inside the garage?
No.
Did anyone go inside the garage?
Not until he surrendered.
So Eskins and Santiago didn't run into the garage and cut to the left?
No.
Did there come a point in time when Santiago pulled out a bunker?
Yes, as soon as he pulled up on the scene, parked the car, jumped out of his car so fast that he left the front door open and pulled out the bunker from the trunk.
By their own accounts, Brown and Philippou were standing in the same spot at the same time, witnessing all the same details of what was going on around them, except for what would have been the most obvious detail of all, each other. Both officers said they didn't realize the other was even at the scene until they switched positions. There are really only a few reasonable explanations for discrepancies this big. One or more of these officers are lying, or there's a portal to another dimension on Eleanora Avenue.
If you listen to their stories, they conflict so much that it's almost like it's conflicting because they are trying to make sure they're in the right place to fit what they're trying to paint.
Yeah.
It's not, to me, when they testify, it's not a, I forgot, or this was long ago, or there was a lot of stuff going on. This is, okay, we actually sat down at some point, tried to get our shit together. And then when we're on the stand, we're trying to remember where the fuck we were.
Yeah.
And we're trying to remember what you said and what you said. I think if they were able to hear what each other said, it would be solid.
Yeah.
But they can't.
Right.
And so it comes off, were y'all at the same scenes?
Right.
With every officer that is added to the scene, the more tangled and messy the different threads of the story become. Officers were swearing under oath to seeing things that they simply could not have. And Officer Israel Lopez was particularly bad at it.
Do you recall at the time that you were at the garage, if you saw any other persons inside the garage aside from the defendant?
No. As I was pulling up to the scene, I seen two people run out of the garage. and that was when everything started.
Do you recall what gender those two people are?
I wouldn't be able to say, ma'am.
Do you recall what those people looked like?
I wouldn't be able to say.
After the first shots were reported, it still took dispatch several minutes to pry an exact location out of the officers on scene before backup units could be dispatched. And since Martina and Bernard ran out of the garage just as the first shots were being fired, Lopez couldn't have been there to see it. Keith's attorney, Latoya Francis Williams, had an easy time finding the weak spots in Lopez's testimony.
You testified that when you arrived on the scene, shots were already being fired in this case?
Yes, ma'am.
You remember who was shooting?
I wouldn't be able to tell. It was just a high stressful incident. Like, I remember Eskins firing, yes, but I don't remember if Santiago was firing yet.
And you remember Eskins firing because you saw Eskins fire?
Yes.
When you heard firing?
Yes.
Yes and yes?
Yes, ma'am.
So you heard firing and you saw firing?
Yes, ma'am.
And Santiago, did you hear Santiago firing at the same time as Eskins?
I wouldn't be able to remember.
When you arrived on the scene, what officers were present?
Officer Eskins, Sergeant Santiago, Officer Filippo, Officer Diana Brown, and that's all from what I recall.
And of those individuals, what do you remember each of them doing upon your arrival?
I don't remember what all of them were doing, man. I mean, it was a high stressful situation. I just remember shots being fired and I took cover. I can't account for where everyone was.
I'm asking, what did you observe your fellow officers doing?
Taking cover.
Objection, ask and answer.
Sustained.
Did you observe anyone firing their weapons?
I seen Eskins fire his weapon when I pulled up to the scene.
How many times did Eskins fire his weapon?
I can't account for how many shots Officer Eskins fired.
Did you hear anyone firing their weapons?
Yes, ma'am.
How many shots did you hear?
I wouldn't be able to say.
You're just saying you don't know?
I don't know, ma'am.
Did you fire your weapon?
Yes, ma'am.
How many shots did you fire?
Two.
Do you know where those shots went?
No.
Lopez can't hide his nerves when he's being less than truthful, but Catherine Philippou is the opposite. She's almost unflappable. Take, for example, her account of switching positions from the left side of the bay doors to behind the passenger door of Santiago's Tahoe. This is where Philippou claims she had the best view inside the garage and the best tactical position to discharge her weapon. Seriously.
I couldn't see that well, so that's when I repositioned myself behind his car, the ship commander's black SUV, and that's when I had a clear line of sight of what was going on.
So this clear line of sight, were you looking directly into the garage?
Yes.
And when you looked directly into the garage, what was immediately in front of you?
Well, it was a little spacious in the beginning. Towards the middle region, there was a fridge where the defendant was standing behind.
And I'm going to now show you what's marked as State's Exhibit 17. Do you recognize that?
Yes.
Is that the fridge you're talking about?
Yes.
And as you look at that fridge, is that fridge in front of the garage door?
I can't tell by that picture. But the fridge is towards the middle region of the garage. That's like a side angle or something.
If you look at defendant's five, can you identify what objects you see that are standing next to the fridge, to the right of the fridge first, please?
This one's just a really bad picture. It looks like a red cabinet. Yeah, some kind of storage item, I guess.
Do you see any poles?
The lift.
Aside from the lift, do you see a bright red pole?
Yes, towards the left.
Is this view on Defense Exhibit 5 your view from standing outside of the garage?
It doesn't. That's a very unclear picture, so.
Is it unclear because it's dark?
Objection.
Sustain.
Why is it unclear?
Objection.
Sustain.
When you looked into the garage from standing on the outside, was it dark inside the garage?
It wasn't that dark.
How is dark if not that dark? Can you describe that?
That I was able to see clearly the whole time. The defendant, when he popped out from the side of the fridge and when he put the gun on top and when he was towards the left of it and the right of it, you could see all that. And the fridge is bright white.
Several people I've interviewed for this podcast were confident that Philippou was the first officer to fire her weapon that morning. Here's what Kelly told me when I first began interviewing her for this podcast in mid-November.
I honestly believe Philippou shot first. Mm-hmm. I believe that she was roughed up those days before. She was in an incident where her gun was taken.
Oh.
And she was on edge.
Yeah.
And she probably should have been taken off the street, and she wasn't.
I got a copy of the arrest report for that incident, and while it was certainly a volatile domestic situation involving a pregnant woman and her parents, Philippou's life wasn't in peril. She didn't lose her gun, but she did sustain a few minor abrasions to her left elbow. That said, I can only imagine that protecting a very pregnant woman from her own mother's vicious assault ranks pretty high on the list of stressful incidents that may warrant a day off. Maybe Philippou was still on edge the following morning, and it contributed to her decision to fire her weapon 3 times at Keith Davis Jr. Two days after that conversation with Kelly, the theory that Philippou fired first had renewed significance when Baltimore Sun reporter Justin Fenton dropped this bombshell.
The FBI was actively investigating a Baltimore police officer for alleged ties to drug trafficking. The documents show that a confidential human source contacted the FBI and told them that Officer Catherine Philippou was helping a drug dealer transport drugs to Philadelphia. It's unclear what came of the investigation, but Philippou resigned from the police force in June.
This news about Philippou came on the heels of the federal case against the members of BPD's Gun Trace Task Force, an elite specialized unit that was supposed to be tracking the sale and criminal history of illegal firearms. Nearly all the officers in the unit had a documented decade-long history of unchecked misconduct. So naturally, BPD's top brass decided they should be working together with very little oversight. Led by Sergeant Wayne Jenkins, the GTTF embodied a whole new level of police corruption. I talked to local Baltimore reporters Baynard Woods and Brandon Soderberg, who are set to publish a book on the GTTF early next year. Here's Brandon.
There's the long, long history of street rumors and street facts where people claim they've had guns and drugs planted on them by the police and the Baltimore police. It's certainly not an outrageous accusation or a conspiracy theory that police do this. It's happened in other cities. And certainly, you know, you would often hear cops plant guns, cops carry around a bag of guns, they drop them on people. And so to suggest that's crazy or outrageous in the first place is really problematic. And then as you have the Gun Trace Task Force indictments and the trial in which it was revealed that a sort of really, really common practice, like a kind of MO of this task force, was having BB guns to drop on people if they did do what sometimes in cop language is called a bad shot or a shooting they may not be able to get away with, basically. And so if you have a bunch of officers that are like ready to go with that and have BB guns on hand for this to happen, then it certainly makes Keith's shooting and the suggestion that maybe a gun was planted on him way even less outrageous. And I think that the Gun Trace Task Force, in a way, is probably the most extreme example of police corruption in like American history, and yet it hasn't really, it's still sort of a piece of trivia. It hasn't quite become the massive story you would have expected. But I do think that the one thing about the task force that has really traveled the most, that you still see people talking about it, you still see stories in this regard being passed around, especially of Vice stories. I think the story that immediately resonated whether you were in this city or you were somewhere else in the country, is the planting BB guns thing. And I think that element of the story really traveled because it rung so true to so many people, especially black people, who encounter the police and have been caught up in the system as true. And so it's not like people weren't passing stories around guns being planted by the task force because it was so shocking and new, the way, say, that the gun trade task force was also robbing and re-dealing drugs into the city and that kind of thing. What really got people about the story was, it's like, look, this thing that we've been saying, that like generations of people have been saying, here is evidence under oath that it happened.
Keith's supporters had long believed that the Hammerly Trailside 22 was one of these so-called drop guns placed on top of the refrigerator after the shooting was over. Here's Baynard Woods.
The defense tried to get out that the gun could have been there for other reasons from other people, and possibly the police planted the gun. It's something that, had that case exactly as it was gone to court right now, I think that the jury would have had a much easier time believing that he didn't have the gun. Keith Gladstone was just indicted for planting a BB gun on a person that Wayne Jenkins ran over. Jenkins was reported to have told his squad to carry BB guns in case they accidentally shot the wrong person. And Fabian Lurande and his partner Charlie Newshaw were being sued at that same time for someone that they shot, saying that they planted a BB gun.
The revelations about Philippou being involved in serious drug trafficking came too late to make an impact on Keith's armed robbery case, but it offered a direct response to a question Keith's supporters have heard time and time again. Do you really think the cops would plant a gun and lie under oath and do other illegal things to protect their own interests? Later that week, Megan Kenny and I basked in the thrilling righteousness of the answer.
Yes, you know why? Because they admit that they do. And now, this week, we found out that one of them is a fucking drug dealer.
Yes.
With an access to a bunch of dirty guns.
She would have had one just sitting in her fucking car.
Exactly.
It could be her goddamn gun.
Keith's former attorney, LaToya Francis Williams, agrees.
Now that I see Filippo has been under FBI investigation, I've always believed either Eskins or Filippo or Santiago brought it to the scene. I've always believed that. However, I don't know which one did. Remember, the district station is literally right on the corner. I've had cases where I'm looking at bodies on camera and officers pick up what appears to be a handgun or perhaps sometimes even a handgun. They don't bag it. No one's wearing gloves. They drop it in the trunk of their car. And the body worn camera is rolling. They go to the hospital. They make another stop. They go to a domestic violence scene. Still haven't gotten to evidence control.
Right, it could have been in one of their cars. It could have been in Santiago's car.
They call them burners. No, that's real.
Yeah.
That's very real. We in Baltimore, we call them burners. And so officers literally will walk around. No different than what they do with drugs. If they take a little heroin or marijuana off of someone and they need to use it as blackmail, they just drop it in the trunk of their vehicle. And, you know, if they report you in East Baltimore and they ask you about a shooting and you don't know, you don't be surprised if an officer says, look what I found in your vehicle.
Right.
And that's that.
Yeah.
So I don't know where exactly it came from. However, I do know it was fishy that the gentleman, supposedly the registered owner of the handgun, did not report it stolen until after he had a conversation with the detective.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So did he talk to Boyd?
It appeared he talked to Boyd, and Boyd had talked to Vini. That's the way the discovery read.
Okay. So did you get in contact with that guy?
He never returned. He never returned calls.
No.
I wasn't successful in getting through him. Reached out on multiple occasions, but.
The first six episodes of this podcast have been focused on the state's case against Keith Davis Jr. for surviving a police shooting on the morning of Sunday, June 7th, 2015. Keith was subsequently prosecuted for various crimes based almost entirely on the word of the police officers who shot him and evidence gathered and ignored by investigators who had already determined he got what he deserved. Nothing has changed. This will continue to play out in court in July, when Keith faces his fourth trial in his second case, a murder that occurred 5 hours before Keith was shot by police and thus became the lead detective's sole suspect. This Thursday on Undisclosed, an introduction to the murder of Kevin Jones and the state's case against Keith Davis Jr. Huge thanks to Team Keith, Angela Bernico, Peggy Amaker Murphy, Megan Kenny, Zach Zweigel, Chris Cummo, Payam Sarabi, Kwame Rose, and the many other people who have supported Keith and Kelly over the last 4 years. Thank you, Kelly, for being remarkably open and honest in all of our conversations and for allowing us to get to know who Keith really is as a husband and father and human being. Keith, we're good friends now, just so you know. Thank you to Rabia, Susan, and Colin for allowing me to come back and hijack their podcast. Thank you to Nick Riley and Daniel Rice from the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at the Georgetown University Law Center. That is a mouthful. Thank you so much for all that you're doing to challenge Maryland's bogus no broadcasting rule. You guys are rad. Thank you to executive producer Meetal Talhan for all her great advice, like reminding me not to read mean Facebook comments. Without sound producer Rebecca Lavoie, each episode would just be a series of audio clips at wildly different volumes with abrupt transitions and lots of weird background noises. So thank you for working your magic every week, Rebecca. I really want to thank Erica Fladell, Don Logis, Britta Bliss, and Skylar Park. I hope I did not butcher your last names. These ladies volunteer their time each week to transcribe every episode. You can find those transcripts on our website, undisclosed-podcast.com. I hope you'd enjoyed learning a little Baltimore slang this season. Thank you to our sponsors for keeping the lights on. And of course, thank you so much to all of our listeners for tuning in every week. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Our handle is undisclosedpod. And don't forget to rate us on iTunes. See you next week.